Coming to you across the ether at the speed of light, it's the Mortgage Moment with Mark Wells of Preferred Financial. My friends tell me I have a face for radio, and Carrie Deese, ninja processor, fending off evil underwriters who want to turn your loan down. Join us for the next hour. We're going to take a look at how to prepare for your mortgage application. So, Carrie, when you decide to buy a house, it's quite a process.
It is quite a process.
And there are some starting points that will help that process. There's some things you can do ahead of time, and some of the things you choose to do ahead of time are going to save you a lot of headaches later on.
Sure.
So we want to talk about how you get ready for that mortgage transaction when you're going to buy a house. I think we'd always have to put at the very top of our list, at the earliest time, even when you just start thinking that you may want to buy a house, the very first thing you want to do is do a quick credit checkup with your mortgage broker. Now, I say with your mortgage broker because there are a lot of consumer credit tracking systems out there, but those all have one big problem, and that is they don't give you a FICO score. They give you a different type of score. Carrie, what type scores do you see in the consumer credit tracking companies?
Those are usually called either Plus or Vantage scores.
That's right, and unfortunately, they are only estimates of FICO, and the reason they're estimates of FICO is the FICO is a proprietary scoring system that is proprietary to each of the three different mortgage bureaus, and so Plus and Vantage tries to estimate what your FICOs are. The problem we find is that it's not always accurate.
And sometimes they'll say that they're giving you your FICO, or they'll say, for instance, they're giving you an Experian score, and that may be the case, but we have to pull all three bureaus and use the middle score of the three. So because not all accounts report to all bureaus, just one score isn't necessarily the accurate picture.
So you need all three bureaus, as Carrie has said, and you need all three FICOs, and we might further confuse the whole situation. There are some FICO models that are not mortgage FICOs. So I have seen one or two consumer-provided credit scores that said they were a FICO, but then they were like in the 900s, and that's not a mortgage FICO. So best thing to do, call your mortgage broker, call us. And Carrie, how can they reach us?
If you don't know it by heart by now, 864-235-9596, or email us at themortgagemoment@gmail.com.
Either way, we can pull your credit report. We won't charge you for it. It'll give you your FICOs. And in addition to that, and this is the most important thing, is that when we pull your credit report with your FICOs, we're going to also get the factors that most affected your score. And this is the key to determining what you may or may not need to do between now and buying a house. And there are a lot of things you may want to do, but there's also a lot of things you want to avoid doing, and we can help you chart those. Once we know what your factors are, we can help you in maintaining the score that you have, if it's the score you want, or getting a better score by the time you buy, which may be a few months down the road. Either way, we can. The factors that show up on your credit report, we know that there are about 40 different factors. We know that they're all negative factors. In that each FICO score system starts with a score. Each bureau has a different starting score, but all of the factors are subtractions from that score. It's not really a matter of how much each one impacted you. It's just relatively how much did it impact you. Everyone generates factors. No one has a perfect score. The question is, how many points have those factors taken off? And when we have your credit report in front of us, we can tell that. It can give us some idea about what you might want to do. For instance, one of the quick and easy ways in which you can improve your credit score, if one of your factors is proportion of balance to credit limit, meaning you've got too much charged on a charge card compared to the credit limit they give you, well, we can usually fix that between now and when you buy the house. A couple of ways to do it. One is to pay down the balance on your credit card. The other is to raise the credit limit. So if we intercept this early enough, we've got a chance of helping you get your score in better shape in order to buy a house. Now, Carrie, what is the impact of a credit score on your mortgage process? What can it affect as you're trying to buy a house?
It actually has a really big impact. It can affect everything from the rate, the program that you qualify for, the loan-to-value ratio that you'll qualify for.
Exactly. It can affect not only the interest rate you get, but it can be restrictive of the type of program you may be eligible for. So you may not be able to get into the best type of program because your score doesn't meet the criteria. The other factor that has really come up within the last few years is that now PMI premiums are priced according to credit score.
Mm-hmm.
And I had one I was working on this morning, and just if we got the borrower up 14 points, the PMI premium on his transaction went from $275 a month down to $205. So just a small 14-point increase made a huge difference in his monthly payment. And so your credit score is going to affect those. It also affects your underwriting itself, whether you might be approved on a conventional loan with 5% down or whether your score is lower and you may have to put more down. Then there are a couple of other things that you don't normally think about along the way that credit scores impact. What's one of those, Carrie, that is kind of the unknown that you didn't realize they were looking at it and pricing you accordingly?
Your homeowner's insurance premium.
Yeah, I was playing golf with my insurance agent the other day, and we were talking about that, and we had quoted a premium to a client, and it seemed high, and I mentioned that to him. He said, well, you know, the credit score was a 640, and that's why he got that premium. So why, and I asked him, so tell me, why is it the case that a person with a lower credit score gets a worse homeowner's insurance premium? And it's because people that are in credit distress will often create an insurable incident where they get money.
Are you serious?
That's right. And so there's the potential for insurance fraud that goes skyrockets as someone's scores drop. So they grade you according to your credit score, and you can pay a higher homeowner's premium because you have a lower credit score. Because you're, even though we know you're not going to be the one doing it, some bad people out there, when they get in credit trouble, all of a sudden they're house burns down, or you know, their car crashes into something, they use it to get money to bridge them over for a while. So even the impact across the board of your interest rate that you're going to pay for 30 years, of your PMI premium you're going to probably pay for 9 years, and your homeowner's insurance premium, which you'll always have, all of these things your scores can affect. So that's why we want to do an early credit check to get you in the best possible terms for your home when you get ready to buy it. Now, also, when you do a credit check with your mortgage broker, he should have, and we have the capacity, to take that credit report and run your loan scenario, your purchase scenario, through an automated underwriting system. Carrie, explain to our listeners what the automated underwriting system does and why it's so important to a loan approval eventually.
It takes all of your loan data, your income, your credit scores, your past credit history, reserves, which is extra money left over after your funds to close, and it puts them into a system and gives us either an automated approval or a refer, which means that it's not able to give an automated approval.
And when we have the automated approval, the beauty of that is, prior to the crash, that was a loan approval that a human underwriter could not overturn. Since the crash, the human underwriters are empowered to overturn that decision, but it's really very rare that it happens. If we have an automated underwriting approval, as long as the information we used to do that is accurate, it is pretty well, you can be 95% certain your loan is going to go through when it gets to an actual human underwriter. So from the automated underwriting system, we can then give you a pre-qualification letter. And when we get back off the break, we'll talk about the types of pre-qualification letters we do. The first one we will do for you is a general one that you can use to engage a realtor to help you with your search for a home. When we get back off the break, we'll talk some more about preparing for the mortgage process when you're buying a home. Thanks for joining us this morning. We're looking at how to prepare for your mortgage application when you're buying a home. We're going to cover a lot of ground here. Talked about the importance of doing as early a credit check as possible. If you just have in the back of your mind that you might want to buy a house in the coming year or so, you should contact us. Let us pull your credit report. And from there, we can do an automated underwriting scenario to see where you stand and where your loan would stack up in an actual underwriting scenario. And then from that, we can generate for you a pre-qualification letter. Now, the first pre-qualification letter we do for you is one that is for your realtor. That's someone you might want to help you assist in finding a home. And this is a general letter. It basically says, Mr. and Mrs. Jones have been pre-approved to purchase a home up to an amount of $250,000. It just lets your realtor know that they're not wasting their time taking you out looking for 20 homes, and that way there's no ill will between you after they find out you didn't really qualify, you were just dreaming. So your realtor's going to want to see that letter, and that letter is in general terms. Now, when you get ready to make an actual offer, and let's say you're qualified to a $250,000 home that we had given your realtor a letter for, and you're going to make an offer on a $230,000 home, well, we don't want you to use the $250,000 letter for the $230,000 offer, because then the seller's just going to say, well, hey, they're good to $250,000. We'll just go on up to $250,000. So when you get ready to make your first offer, we have you call us back, give us the address of the house you're putting an offer in on, and the exact offer price you're going to make. And we do a letter that matches that so that your seller knows that you are capable of delivering on the offer you're making, but isn't necessarily clued in to the fact that you might be able to go $5,000 more, $10,000 more. That's just something that leaves you in a little stronger negotiating position. So the two pre-qualification letters are really critical. We have to have a credit check in order to do that. The beauty of the automated underwriting systems is that the pre-approval letter that we do is as strong a loan commitment as you can get up front. It's what I say is your 95%er. It's very rare that a human underwriter is going to overturn an automated underwriting decision.
Now, if you have a situation that you think might need some additional attention before we can do a pre-approval letter, we can always submit your loan to a lender for an underwrite without a property attached. And that will give you a better comfort level if you really want to do things up front for a better percentage of approval rate.
And that's a good thing to bring up. Most of our lenders have what they call a scenario desk, and it allows us to submit your application papers with your credit and the automated underwriting decision, and then address a particular issue that might arise in underwriting. We basically preempt the issue so that you don't get all the way to a contract into the process of buying the home only to find out you're going to be turned down. So if you have a special situation, and these can run the gamut from the job type you might have, how you may be compensated at work, whether certain structures to your pay can be used as qualifying income. There are just, it seems like, Carrie, every month we do two or three of these scenario desk questions where someone just has a situation that falls a little outside of the norm where it may be interpreted one way or the other. We can get an answer up front before you ever go out there and find your dream house only to be crushed that you can't buy it because the lender said, no, you can't do this. So that's a good point. We can do, beyond the automated underwriting, we can do any scenario underwriting. And these are at no charge and no obligation, but it certainly gives you peace of mind. The last thing you want to do is go out there, find your dream house, only to find out you can't buy it. Now, after you have taken care of an early credit check with your mortgage broker, done your upfront credit assessment, underwriting, automated underwriting, you then want to determine a couple of things. Number one, how much house can you afford? And number two, what type of housing is it that you want to buy? Carrie, let's talk about the types of housing you might want to buy. Why would you want to kind of get an early determination of that?
Well, you know, there's some big differences. The most common is just a regular single family residence. It's not attached to anything else. Then you have your townhouses and condos, which if you listen to our show on different property types, you know that there are actually some differences there. And condos are a little bit more difficult to get approval on just because based on the loan program, they have some pretty deep reviews that they have to do to make sure that the condo is approved.
Yeah, particularly if you're interested in buying an attached townhouse or a condominium, you want to early on know which loan program you're qualified for. So, for instance, if your only option is FHA, it's going to be difficult to find a condominium association in which you can purchase a condo using an FHA loan. So that might turn your attention to townhouses, which FHA has no restrictions on, rather than condominiums, horizontal regimes, where the condo association has to be approved ahead of time by FHA.
And VA is the same
way. VA is the same way. That's correct. Now, one of the steps in pre-qualifying you, we will have looked at your debt-to-income ratios. Debt-to-income ratios tell the lender and tell us how much house you can afford, and there are two debt ratios. One, how much of your qualifying income is it going to take to make your house payment? And then the second ratio is how much of your income is it going to take to service all of your debt once the house has been purchased. The reason debt ratios are important is that lenders have kept statistical information for 75 years in which they have determined at what point does debt become too burdensome where it sends someone into a financial spiral they cannot get out of that results in a foreclosure. The reason the lenders want to know where those pressure points are is they don't want to foreclose on anyone. Despite what you might think about lending institutions out there, the biggest loss for a lending institution is a foreclosed home. They don't want those. And so their underwriting is done in a manner that sets the debt levels where, apart from a catastrophic event, you would never experience a situation where you would be put into a foreclosure. So debt ratios can be good guidelines. We have, I find this, Carrie, that most people that come in that have good credit scores already without anyone telling them what a debt ratio is, they know how much house they can afford and what they'll be comfortable with. It's amazing to me that the financially responsible just inherently feel where that pressure point is and how much money they would want to go into a house. I find, on the other hand, that sometimes people have been more careless with their credit scores, have unrealistic expectations about what their house payment might could be. And so what we can do early on is set the expectations in line with the market. And the earlier you do this, to me, the real advantage of knowing how much house you can buy today, even if you're not going to buy for 6 months to a year, is that that gives you time to look out there at the market. It lets you determine, okay, for $250,000, what kind of house can I get? And it lets you begin to look at areas that you might shop in, because you may be trading off a little more house, square footage-wise, to be a little further out. And you've got to look at commuting distances and commuting costs. The earlier you do this, the more you are armed with information that lets you make an informed choice when you get ready to buy a house.
And on that vein, I want to touch quickly just on manufactured homes. A lot of times, it's kind of a go-to for people who think that it's a more cost-effective option. We are limited on loan programs. There are some extra guidelines that go with it, but also, you're typically going to have a higher insurance premium on a manufactured home, so that takes up a little bit more of your income, and it's going to have a higher rate, so your payment might be a little bit higher.
Again, when we look at these early on, we can assess all of the property types you may be considering, look at the pros and cons of the lending programs that are available for those, and again, if you're armed with information, you will make the decision that is right for you and your family. So our intent in all of this work up front is not so much to steer you as it is to show you what your options are so you can make the best choices. Now, we find, too, one question that I ask, and I usually kind of ask it before I tell them how much house they could afford. I ask the question, how much of a house payment do you want to make? And again, that's often very much in line with the allowable debt ratios. But, you know, sometimes people don't want to be what they would call house poor. They don't want their house payment to take up so much of their monthly income that they can't enjoy some of the other things they like doing. So again, as you're looking at purchasing a home, you're looking at establishing a lifestyle for the next 5 to 10 years. And so you may not want to buy as much house as you could buy. What we can help you with is if you say to us, well, Mark, I don't want my payment to be a penny over $1,250, we can say, okay, here's your purchase price range. Here's where you can look for housing. And, you know, there can be differences. Taxes can be higher in the city or the county. So all of those things can be known up front so that you're an informed shopper when you go out to start looking for a home. After you've taken care of credit issues, after you've determined how much house you want to buy or how much house you can buy, Carrie, what would you say is the next most important thing to begin as early as possible?
Saving and documenting your funds for your down payment.
Because apart from credit, which is a threshold you have to be over to even consider buying a home, the next biggest concern and the next biggest hurdle is your down payment. And that would be how much down payment are you going to need in dollar terms for the house you want to buy, for the program that you're qualified for, and where is that down payment going to come from? We've talked in past programs, but Carrie, let's visit again. What are some acceptable sources of down payment for a buyer with most of our programs?
Funds that have been in your checking and savings for at least 60 days. Your 401k, you could have a withdrawal. We'll go over the rules in just a little while. You could sell an asset, such as a car. And again, we'll go over how to document that. Could be wedding gifts, tax refunds. It just can't be borrowed.
That's kind of the single biggest thing that is maybe a misunderstanding out there. Two things that simply cannot be done in regard to down payment. You cannot borrow it. And it cannot come from a party who has a vested financial interest in the transaction. So that means your realtor can't give you your down payment, your seller can't give you the down payment, or anyone who would benefit financially cannot give it to you unless they're a near relative where they can gift you the equity. When we get back, we're going to talk about some of the ways we need to document down payment, how you can save yourself a lot of headaches and a lot of time by doing things ahead of time. Time for your second cup of coffee. We're back after the break. We're talking about preparing for the mortgage process, the process of buying a home, the importance of doing things really early on in order to both inform you so you that you can make the best choice when you go out to buy, but also to just preempt any potential issues that might arise, whether those be credit issues, the type of house you may want to buy, the programs you may be eligible for, and to take care of down payment, which we were talking about right before the break. Carrie, gifts are allowed really with most any loan program that we have, but the documentation of the gift we find can cause a lot of distress. And mainly we see that distress in that the giver is required to document in many cases. They have the capacity to give, and they don't like that because that involves providing a bank statement showing certain of their assets. They feel like that's a private situation. Why should anybody care? Uh-huh. Again, all of these regulations that we deal with are because there has been loan fraud perpetrated in the past. And they do sometimes seem invasive. They seem unreasonable. But they really do have good reasons for being there. One of the ones that just seems to really make people upset is if they're going to give some money to their children to help them with their house, we have to have certain things from them, and it seems invasive. So there's a couple of ways we could just totally circumvent the gift process, the gift documentation process. How can we do that?
You know, if they give it early enough, more mm-hmm. than 60 days before you apply, we don't have to document anything because 60 days in the mortgage world means it's your own funds.
So this is just a suggestion. It just saves you a lot of hassle. And for the giver, it saves the intrusion of having mm-hmm. to find out where the money came from, how it got there. Just give your child or whoever you're helping the money 60 days. Now, not 60 days ahead of when they're going to close their loan, but 60 days ahead of when they're going to sign a contract.
Right.
Because we have to document the 60 days prior to the contract to see how much money was in the borrower's account. Well, if it's already there, we don't have to explain it. But if we put it in during the last 60 days, we've got to trace it, track it, explain it, and it's kind of a hassle, and it's intrusive. So talk to us about down payment and down payment needs. If you have a special situation, we can be reached at 864-235-9596. We put in a brand new phone system to handle your call, and sure enough, we've had nothing but difficulty with it. So we realized this morning that it was shutting people off into a non-existent voicemail. We apologize if that was your experience, but we've got it straight. So give us a call now. We will answer the phone, or we'll trip over ourselves trying to get to the phone before it quits ringing. All right. So, Carrie, I would say if I was going to give advice to someone planning to buy a house in the coming year, is become a good record keeper.
Absolutely.
So what kind of records are we going to need when they apply for the mortgage loan? What do you need to just have in a folder that says buying a house folder? What can they put in there?
Your most recent 2 years of tax returns and your W-2s. Now, don't depend on your CPA to have put your W-2 in your tax returns.
That's right. A lot of tax preparers, they put the amount of the W-2 on the right line, but they do not provide you with a copy of your W-2. So make sure you've got that. And I'm sorry, Kier, which tax return? Because people say, well, so any state tax return?
Nope, just the federal.
Just the federal.
Now, all pages of, we don't need worksheets, but all pages and schedules of the federal. So not just the first two pages.
That's right. The 1040 is the first two pages. And then if you filed any other federal schedules, we need to see those also.
Mm-hmm.
Great. What else do they need to stick in their folder?
If you're self-employed, we're going to need the most recent 2 years self-employed tax returns.
And those could be like a sub-S corporation, if they have a corporation.
Sure.
LLC, LLP. And there's usually a document that goes along with those that's called a K-1. The K-1 indicates to the lender and to everyone what percent of the corporate or partnership entity you own.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's critical because there's a dividing line. If you're below the line, you're not considered self-employed. If you're above it, you are. What's that number, Carrie?
25%.
Okay, so if you own 25% or more of an LLC, an LLP, sub-S corporation, C corporation, you are, by definition, to the lender, a self-employed borrower, and we will have to have those business tax returns. If you own less than 25%, if you own 24.99 or less, all we need is the K-1 from those entities. We don't need the tax returns
right
themselves. So the 25% rule applies there. Just keep it in mind. If you just want to be safe, stick your company tax returns in there because somebody may want to see them anyway.
And if you just are confused by all of that and don't know what to provide, feel free to just bring us the whole shebang. We'll pull out
we'll weed out a copy of it. That's right.
We do it all the time.
It's the kind of thing. And more, the more paper we can bury an underwriter with, the better we are. So. We'll throw it at them, and sometimes we think that the underwriter really makes their decision by weighing the paper, not by what's actually in the paper. So we just load it up if we need to. Now, a business owner is also going to need another very important set of documents. So you need to be keeping these. These do not have to be audited by a CPA. They don't even have to be CPA prepared. But we've got to have a profit and loss statement. It brings us up to date from the date of the last tax return you have. So this time of the year, not everyone has filed a 2017 business tax return. Well, if you haven't done that, then we're going to need a profit and loss for 2017. But we're also going to need a profit and loss statement for the year 2018 up year to date. Just always remember that as self-employed, you not only need your last 2 years filed tax returns, but you'll need a prepared or what we call a compiled profit and loss statement that brings us up to date since your last tax return. And this is important. Carrie, what do the underwriters look for in a profit and loss statement? What is it they're really trying to hunt down? Because it's not an official document as such. It hasn't been filed with the government. What are they looking for?
They're just looking to make sure that your current income is on target to meet at least what you made the previous year.
Okay, that's right. What they're not wanting to see is declining income.
Mm-hmm.
If you have declining income, again, that's one of those qualification issues that we can either preempt with a scenario desk to see if this is something that's going to kill your loan prospects or if it's something that we can deal with. Sometimes we can actually go back further in tax returns and show that, hey, this really wasn't a decline. It's just last year was a huge year, and this year was more normal. So there are ways around what appears to be declining income. Again, far better to preempt these issues very early on before you ever get into contract and get ready to buy a house. We can make sure that all of these comply with the lender's needs. What other things should you stick in your record-keeping folder while you're getting ready to buy a house?
Keep up with your pay stubs and your bank statements.
That's right. And, you know, you may not just want to print every bank statement every month. Yeah, it might not be a bad idea to do anyway. We have gotten used to electronic record keeping, but, you know, with my stuff, I usually print a hard copy just in case, who knows, the bank site crashes or I just need evidence that I had a depository account somewhere. But at the time you apply, you will need your most recent 2 months' bank statements. So you want to begin to keep those in the file also.
And I will just quickly say, anytime you make a big deposit for anything, if you do sell a car, if you do get a gift, make copies of everything. Do not use cash for anything, ever.
That is the one thing that is untraceable and unusable and gives us the most problem is if you have money in the cookie jar, take it down to the bank more than 60 days before you sign a contract.
Yep.
And then it's in your account and we can count it. It is not possible to document the source of cash, so that's why it's not allowed as a legitimate source of down payment.
Mm-hmm.
The only exception to that, and I will mention this, because it seems there's always some exception to the rule, but if you are of a culture that does not use bank accounts at all, then there are some programs that will allow you to use cash. Those are very restricted, and proving that you are within an ethnic community or a culture that does not use bank statements requires some third-party verifications that we can help you obtain if you really do just deal in cash and do not believe in using a bank account. Now, we're going to move from some mortgage-related items, which are critical. I mean, that's your most critical first step in when you before you ever go out to buy a house, you want to take care of those things. But let's talk about some of the peripheral things that you just want to do to get prepared for buying a home. The item I'm talking about here is what I would call setting up your team. And to borrow from that famous political statement, it takes a village. It takes a village to buy a house, meaning it takes the coordination of a lot of effort with a lot of people, and you want to assemble for yourself a competent team to transact your purchase. The most important and first one is your mortgage broker. We would, of course, love to be your mortgage broker, and we're happy to provide all these services we've talked about. But the very first thing you want to put, the first person you want on your team is your financing team. If you don't have financing, there is nothing else to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the first thing to get going. You want to do your credit check with TrueFICOs. You want to do your pre-qualification with automated underwriting. Your mortgage broker is your number one guy on your team. Set him up first. When we get back off the break, we're going to talk about how to set up the rest of your team. Believe it or not, there's going to be 6 or 8 more players that you're going to need along the way to make sure that your transaction goes smoothly, to make sure you anticipate any issues that might arise, to make sure that if and issues invariably arrive, that you have the type of people that will be looking for solutions and not throwing obstacles in your way. So when we get back off the break, we'll talk about those. So far this morning, we've helped you set up your mortgage and financing situation so that you can prepare for the home buying process. But now we're going to talk about putting together the rest of your team.
And before we get to that, just a reminder, call us 864-235-9596. Email us at themortgagemoment@gmail.com. and check out our website at preferredfinancialgreenville.com to listen to past shows. Now, just know that sometimes there is about a 7-day lag before we are able to post that. So if you're looking for a specific one and it's not there yet, just keep an eye out. It'll be coming.
Or give us a call. We'll send you the audio of it. If you are missing some of this program today and you're wanting to get this early this week, we'll send it to you as soon as we have it. So, Carrie, I would say after your mortgage broker is in place, your financing guy is in place, the next thing you need to, next person you need to put on your team is a realtor. We do recommend realtors because they're professionals. They know what they're doing. They will probably save you more money than you could save yourself. I know a lot of people say, well, I'm going to try to do this without a realtor and save the 3%. But believe me, a professional realtor can save you far more than 3%. They know the market. They know what's overpriced. They know what should be included. They know what can be pushed and what needs to be shoved and can be a big help. We do recommend a buyer's agent. If you just don't happen to have one, you should engage a buyer's agent. That's someone who will represent you in the transaction and can represent your interests throughout the transaction. They can help you screen your properties. They really, I think, one of the biggest services they provide is they're kind of a third party in the negotiation process. And it's kind of like the good cop, bad cop, or it's kind of like you go to the car lot and the salesman says, well, I have to go talk to the manager. Well, they don't really have to talk to the manager, but it seems like because they put it in the hands of someone else that it's less emotionally charged. You know, you get an answer back. Well, the same way with a realtor. They can kind of remove some of the emotional, underlying emotional energy that surrounds buying and selling a home. And so they can act as your third-party negotiator.
And typically, the seller is responsible for paying even your realtor's commission.
That's
so
right.
That shouldn't be at a cost to you.
That's right. Even if you're using a buyer's agent, it's not going to cost you to use them probably any more than if you just went and made an offer on a house that was already listed. Because the MLS system allows them to split the commissions. The seller pays those in most circumstances. Carrie, some other people that you want on your team. Who else do we need?
Your inspectors.
Okay.
So your home inspector.
Inspector Gadget?
Oh, okay. go, Gadget Arms.
That's right.
Your home inspector. So always, always, always get a home inspection. We cannot stress that enough.
Yeah, unless you're buying a brand new house that has a warranty, it's just a good idea. You know, it's a relatively inexpensive transaction. It's, what, usually around $300 or so?
Sure.
And what you get out of a home inspection is this thorough assessment of what you're buying. And sometimes it can be kind of intimidating. It looks like an encyclopedia. Well, good grief, what's wrong with this house? But no, it's just telling you in a very understandable format what you might want to notice but really isn't important, what is important enough to warrant a warning that it might be a repair coming down the road somewhere. And it can pinpoint the things that, hey, you better pay attention to this. You don't want to buy this house unless this is fixed. It's a great investment. Probably the best $300 you'll spend. So put a home inspector on your team. What other inspectors do we need?
Your pest inspector. We definitely have termites here in Greenville and in the upstate. So that's a really important inspection.
Yeah, I was really shocked. What is maybe 8 or 10 years ago, they dropped the requirement for a termite letter with conventional financing. Now, FHA and VA still require it. And I tell you what, I would not buy a house in all of our listening area unless you get a termite inspection. Yeah, they also check for powder post beetles. They're a lot more rare, but they're also a lot more devastating. But your house, and I built homes, I pre-treated homes. I can tell you from a builder's perspective, I can tell you from being in this industry for 30 years, you are going to have termites at some point if you have a house. So you don't want to buy one with an active termite problem or a problem that had been there in the past that might have created some structural issues. It might have been treated and it might not be active, but you want to know if they ever caused any structural damage to your home. So a termite inspector, put him on your list.
If you're in a rural area, the well and septic inspection.
They need to be done. These can be done separately. Generally, the cheapest way to get a well inspection is just let DHEC do it. There's some laboratories, private laboratories that will do it also. Haven't done one recently, but those tests used to run somewhere around $100, $125 for a well test. Basically, they're checking for coliform bacteria, which you don't want in your well because then your household will be sick the first time you sit down and drink some water. Your septic tank can be inspected by any septic tank installer, anyone licensed to do septic systems. Again, these are required, so you need to put them on your team if you're going to be looking in a more rural area.
And if you're doing a government loan, like Mark said, these are required. And if you're going to use DHEC, their turn times are longer, so go ahead and get that in the works quickly. Otherwise, you'll end up paying a private inspector, which is a little bit more costly.
That's right. Good advice. Now, a couple of more people you want on your team, and those that you want to intercept fairly early, too, your homeowner's insurance agent. That's a critical component. Everyone has to have homeowner's coverage. You've got to have insurance, so you need to become familiar with how insurance works. There are different deductibles. That means that if you have a claim, you're going to pay the first $500 or first $1,000 or first $2,000. You have choices with your deductibles, but also your insurance agent can tell you what type of housing might affect your insurance premium. Carrie mentioned that manufactured housing insurance premiums are higher, so you want to be prepared for that if you're going to look at buying manufactured housing. A lot of things that your homeowner's insurance agent can help you with up front, early on, so you make the right decisions going into your transaction. And the last person we want on your team is a closing attorney. I will say this, that throughout all of the years' experience in closing loans, in South Carolina, the attorney has to sit down at the table, and he has to wear a couple of different hats there. He has to represent the lender because they're lending the money, and he's executing legal documents on their behalf. He has to represent the buyer because the buyer's signing legal documents that are binding to him, and he's got to represent the seller. So it's a little bit unusual. How can he do all that at the same time? I will say that in our listing area throughout South Carolina, North Carolina, and into Georgia, the attorneys do an excellent job at that. They understand that it is their fiduciary duty to represent all parties, and they do a good job. But like anything else, like a realtor, like a mortgage broker, like an inspector, like an insurance agent, you want to make sure that the personality and the personnel at the offices of these people that you're going to put on your team are all the type of people you want to work with. We all have different expectations. We all have different things that we like, we dislike. Not everybody always gets along, but no reason to make your home buying journey difficult by having difficult people that you don't like working with. So put these teams together early. I want to talk about some peripheral costs. These are costs that have nothing to do with your loan, nothing to do with your mortgage, not your down payment, but these are things you just might want to be aware of that could include additional expenses that you need to anticipate when you're buying a house. Carrie, let's start down the list of those. What are some things that you may end up paying some money because you just forgot about it, or you didn't think, well, I'm moving, so I might have that expense?
If you're renting from an apartment complex, did you give your 60-day notice, or how long did your individual landlord require?
That's right. You want to make sure that your timing with your lease or your notification is sufficient, mainly to get your security deposit back.
Sure. And some of them, you know, if you don't give them enough notice, require they, you know, charge some kind of a fee for
that. A penalty. That's right. The other thing you want to do is you're going to exit your apartment or house, and you may have a long time ago made a deposit with the utility company that you forgot about. So that's like free money. Because if you didn't have credit when you first applied for electrical power, they usually make you make a $100, $150 deposit. Well, that's probably been sitting there for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, and you forgot you made it. So that's some free money to get back, and it can offset some of the other costs. You may have moving expenses. Best thing is a bunch of strapping teenage boys to help you move. And I have found that the cheapest way to move is steak dinner. They will work all day long for a good steak dinner. But anticipate that those steaks may cost you. You may have moving expenses, sure enough. With equipment, you may be moving enough distance to need a truck. You may be using a professional mover, but don't forget about that. What are some other things, peripheral costs, they may want to be aware of, Carrie?
Appliances and furnishings for your new home.
That's right. Make sure when you go in to negotiate a home, the seller may be planning to take that washer and dryer and that refrigerator out. Now, they can't disassemble and take out anything that's built in, but it could go so far. Not all stoves are built in, so the seller may take your stove. So make sure if you're going to need appliances, you've budgeted for it. You may need to budget for things like homeowner association fees, homeowner association dues and capital fees and transfer fees. These are things that, are associated with condominiums and townhouses, but occasionally even with subdivisions and single-family residences. You may have some expenses in joining the homeowners association associated with your home. So all of these things, and then don't forget, as you're buying a house, you need to give notice to your landlord. You need to give a shutoff date to your utility company so your utilities are shut off and you're not paying for somebody else's electricity after you move. Make sure you abide by your lease agreement. Give enough notice to get your security deposit back. Don't forget, if you sold a house, you've got an escrow refund coming to you. And don't forget to do a forwarding address to the post office so that that gets to you.
And this is so important. After you close, go down to your county tax office. Make sure that they are showing that that is your primary residence so they don't overcharge you for your taxes.
That's another thing to save you some money. Leave a forwarding address with the post office. Don't forget your bills in transition. Make sure that a bill doesn't fall through the crack because you don't want a 30-day late on your credit after you've spent all this time getting your credit ready and available. So leave a forwarding address. Make sure your bills are paid. Make sure you've got your first payment coupon on your new home because you're not likely to have online set up for 30 to 40 days after you buy your house. Change your driver's license to your new address. Change your passport to your new address. All these things will help everything in life go smooth as you're buying a home. Thank you for joining us this morning. It's been great to be with you. Join us again next week on The Mortgage Moment.